This is Peter Gallagher, and you're listening to Get Your Film Fix podcast.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
All right, hello and welcome to this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. I'm Brantley Palmer. Joining me are Tyson Balcom and Jeremy Fisk. On this edition of the podcast, we're going to be talking about the Joss Whedon written and produced film Cabin in the Woods, starring Chris Hemsworth. We're also going to have a tie-in discussion about the delay of the film, why it took so long to finally make it to theaters. And then we're going to wrap everything up with our top five genre-bending movies.
Hello! I'm thinking this thing doesn't take credit cards.
Sign says closed.
We're looking for, what's it called?
Tillerman Road.
Not to get you there. Getting back. That's your concern.
Oh, this is awesome.
Whoa. No way.
Lambs have passed through the gate. They are come to the killing floor.
Get this party started!
I seriously believe something weird is going on.
So, we have with The Cabin in the Woods a fairly, as far as how it was marketed, a fairly straightforward horror film. When you go and you watch the film, obviously it was the filmmaker's intentions to really play with the horror genre. And I don't want to get too far into exactly how they do it because this whole review could be sort of a spoiler review.
Right.
But I want to know what you guys' expectations were, not as far as whether you were excited about it or not, but what your expectations were going into it as far as it being a horror film. And after leaving it, did you find it clever and surprising and fun, or were you like, that's not what I signed up for? And we'll start with you, Tyson.
Well, you know, when I first saw the trailer and the subsequent couple of times that I saw it, you know, leading up to going in to see it, I was looking forward to it because I feel like, you know, a good horror movie is something that you'll always appreciate, but for whatever reason you don't get to see very often, you know, and it's kind of they seem like a lot of times they're focused on one specific time of year, usually in the fall or around Halloween, and so I was looking forward to it because I like a good horror movie as much as any movie if it's good, and I knew a little bit from the trailer that it was obviously, like you said, going to play with the genre a little bit because it was, you could tell that there was something a little bit different about it, you know, that it wasn't as cut and dry as, you know, a group of predictable, you know, teens go and, or 20-somethings go and hang out in some cabin in the middle of nowhere and bad shit happens to them. But, you know, I think I was a little bit disappointed with the outcome, but I wasn't disappointed with the concept. You know what I mean? I think that they had this really cool idea and it was just a little bit, you know, I think that they tried a little bit too hard to, I don't know. I'm not quite sure.
Well,
what
I mean,
specifically,
it's,
you
definitely
know,
a movie that the filmmakers are so aware of the conventions of the genre,
yeah,
where they're playing with it. And I can
right.
see how somebody could take it as, all right, we get that you get horror films. Let us watch this.
Right.
But
and yeah. In a weird way, I sort of felt that way a little bit, you know, that you know, I understand what they were trying to do, and I think that it's very clever, and I see why it's being pretty well received. I just think for me, a little part of me felt like, in here there could have been a really great horror movie, and I think they tried a little too hard to sort of like, you know, they got a little too cute with it. You know what I mean? They tried to keep it a little bit too funny and a little bit too like clever and all that stuff. And I felt like at certain parts, I was like, man, this would be such a great, you know, horror part of this story if they had just stuck with it rather than, it's you know, certain specifics, you know,
comedic and aspects,
exactly,
the
like the
ironic that, aspects.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that in that sense, it was a little bit disappointing. And then I thought that, you know, within the story, I thought there was such a, you know, what they tried to do. And, you know, I don't know how specific we want to get without spoiling it, but like, you know, I think that they could have just done a better job with the payoff. I don't, you know, and at a certain point, when I started to, you know, you have that like break point when you feel like you start to realize where they're going. I just think I was a little bit disappointed with how it ended up. So, What about you, Brantley?
I would disagree kind of on your point, because I had a blast with this movie. It was probably the most fun I've had in the theater all year, so far. I mean, and we're just getting into the summer movie season, so I mean that might change. But
Brantley, before you go on, look, can I just ask you a quick question? Like,
yeah,
did,
sure.
Did you see it for this podcast, or did you see it when it first came out?
No, I saw it for the podcast yesterday.
Okay, so did you know about like a lot of what had been talked about with this movie?
No, I intentionally didn't like read reviews or anything, because some like a lot of the internet critics and stuff who had been talking about it were like, you know, don't read any reviews, don't spoil anything, just go in
blind. So you read reviews to tell you not to read reviews.
No, it was like people's Twitter accounts.
Yeah, okay.
So like when I was on Twitter, I saw them saying, don't read anything, just go in and stuff like that. And I would kind of disagree, though, about like the marketing, too. I feel like the marketing didn't really set it up as like a regular horror movie. I think they kind of played around with the notion that it was weird and different.
Right.
Down to the TV spots, right down to the poster even, in which the cabin is shaped like a Rubik's Cube. I mean, I think they did kind of market it as being, you know, like a deconstruction of the horror genre.
Yeah, and maybe I misspoke. I just mean that they didn't come right out and say that it was going to be this, like, big statement about horror movies in general. Do you know what I mean? Like, I knew from the trailers where they showed, you know, like that shot where the bird hits the barrier, you know, like stuff like that. But I knew that there was going to be this other component to the way that these five people were in this situation. And it was like, you know, and in that sense, I wasn't disappointed. And you know, I mean, I went and saw this movie because I was interested in seeing the movie. I mean, I saw it 2 or 3 weeks ago. I mean, well before when I even knew we were gonna podcast about it, because you know, I really I thought the trailer looked good, and I thought the concept sounded great, and I hadn't read anything about it either. And I just think, I don't know, I feel like I'm not disappointed with the idea. You know, I thought it's such a cool concept, and I just feel like there were a couple of moments where they, like I said, I think they just got like a little too cute with what they were trying to do, and that's kind of what, you know, bummed me out.
Well, I was I had initially heard of it just being like Cabin in the Woods. When I saw the initial trailer of a movie called Cabin in the Woods on iTunes, I didn't even watch it because I thought I knew what it was. And not until this movie came out and started getting really good reviews did I start paying attention and being like, what could possibly be good about another movie of a bunch of 20-somethings going to a cabin in the woods and getting killed? So the reason I'm saying this is I started doing some looking into it, and I knew going into this film that I wasn't going to get a conventional horror film. Mm-hmm. Although I also didn't realize the scale of which this film was, because I had never seen the trailer. I had no idea that we were going to be dealing with such a, I guess, big budget looking film, something that had some great CG, some great makeup, that the world of this movie started out small and sort of really, really expanded into something giant. And that's why I'm surprised, and we're going to talk about it later, that this movie got pushed for so long, because I don't know what the budget was. I guess I could look it up, but I
$12 million.
That's it?
Yeah, I thought it was like 30.
No, it says, well, at least according to Wikipedia, it says 12 million.
Oh, okay. I think IMDb was saying 30. Let me just double check that.
Well, if it's 12 million, that's very impressive because it definitely, like I said, this movie went from a microcosm to expanding its world really quickly with some great CG. And obviously, it was done in a way that it's like making this comment that we are the. They're doing it for the audience. We're the audience that. They are very wink, wink, nudge, nudge aware of, and they even pretty much say it. They call it something else in the film, but we're that audience that wants to see, you know, the hot young people go out and the topless girl, and we want to see the topless girl go and get killed in a very gory way.
Right.
They manipulate that so that the show that they're putting on is not for us, but it's clearly an indication, very similar to sort of the Hunger Games, how it's sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge at what our expectations for this genre are. And you can even look back into like it as a reality show, which you can point to the Hunger Games and say the same thing. So I think it did almost a better job than the Hunger Games on that aspect of it. Well, because it was having more fun than the Hunger Games was. And the Hunger Games was PG-13, and this was rated R. So it's weird that this was the movie that, although all the gore and everything, it was having a lot more fun, while the Hunger Games had to stay within this realm of PG-13, family-friendly, and also dealt with the same sort of topics. So I think in that case, this was a better movie than the Hunger Games.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and if I can mildly talk specifics, one of the things that I, you know, that's one of the things I thought was cool, and I think when I was texting you yesterday, Jeremy, the reason I was disappointed, I'll talk about it a little bit later, was because of the way that the story ended. But, you know, one of the cooler things about this concept was the way that they could kind of play with it even from the very beginning. You've got these two technicians who are these kind of likable guys, you know, setting up this whole situation, and they're doing, you know, they have all these ways in which they can regulate how the story goes.
Well,
you know, from
let's quickly talk about that beginning, because basically we have a beginning that sets us up really quickly, and this isn't really spoiling anything. It sets us up really quickly that this is not going to be a normal horror film, because we get this sort of banal, dreary looking pseudoscientific office space, and then we get these two older guys played by
Richard Jenkins and Bradley Whitford.
Yeah, having basically water cooler talk. And I honestly I had to look around and I'm like, I'm in the right movie, right? This is I really didn't know. And then all of a sudden we get the title, Cabin in the Woods, and it's a laugh. It's a funny moment. And we also realize we're being set up for something. And the way that they reveal that throughout the film, they do it very slowly and particularly as to keep the audience engaged in what is happening.
Yeah, it's and you know that part, you know, where they have all of these methods with which they can control this environment, and we knew from the very beginning when they pull away from their apartment building and that guy's on the roof and he radios back and they you know, they have all of these like the pheromones they were releasing and the. And they're taking all these bets and stuff, and it's a really clever thing. And it's, you know, certain things that happen in that part of the story become clearer as time goes on. Like when they're placing all those bets, and then everybody freaks out when she starts to read the diary, and it's just in that sense, I thought it was a really cool. Like I said, the concept is just really cool because it, you know, it plays with the conventions of a normal a horror story that in a way that you, because we've all seen so many of these stories, you know, we all feel like we're sort of in on the joke, even though, you know, we're watching these five people who aren't, and they try and they have that one security guard who is the like voice of reason about whether or not, you know, this is an appropriate thing to be.
Well, let's talk about that a little farther, and as far as it being sort of, not even sort of, just being a mirror of filmmaking, because you have these guys and you have somebody that we reveal later that comes out and is titled the director.
All right.
So there's that person. Then you have all these different departments. You have electric, you have demolition, you have basically
engineering.
You have all these different departments, just like you do on a film crew.
And or TV studio.
Or TV studio.
Yeah.
What they're trying to... Yeah, exactly, Brantley. Like, what they're trying to do is show you what you want while you're watching what you want. It's really sort of a smart way to dissect how we ingest films.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the control room, let's just call them the control room scenes, were probably some of my favorite.
Okay, Nessun boy, tell us how that works.
Well, I mean, obviously, since I work in TV, it's funny just because, I mean, like, they're punching what are, like, looks like actual, like, TD boards and everything. So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, that was just kind of interesting from my standpoint, working in TV and in those control rooms all the time and seeing them there as if they're running those as well. And plus, just I'm a huge Bradley Whitford and Richard Jenkins fan.
Yeah, they were the
pick
best.
Two better actors.
Yeah, they did a great job.
They were the portray best that. And Jeremy, to your point about us, you know, as if we're the ones like sitting there, like I don't really know how to phrase it, but like either controlling it or as if filmmakers control it. Joss Whedon was saying that those two characters, Jenkins and Whitford, were basically him and Drew Goddard, the other writer. It was basically their voices as they kind of were writing it. So it's funny you bring that up because they literally were, a vessel for the actual filmmakers.
And you can see that, like, if you ever if you've ever had an experience, which I know we all have, of writing with somebody else, what you do is you debate sort of things. Oh, should we put this here? Should we add a scene here where this girl's going to get really slutty? Okay, we'll put up the pheromones. Okay, good. Okay, that's going to work. And you can hear that voice being said through these two men, and it's obviously clever. Now, I guess the question is, we all I guess Brantley and I enjoyed it a little more than Tyson, but does this movie have sort of – is this movie something that we're going to be able to look back on and say, yeah, this movie is really a sign of the times, or are we – is it just what it is? Are we just – is it ultimately in the end what it dissects, fun, a horror comedy?
Well, yeah. You know, I was just thinking because frankly, I'm kind of surprised that it's taken this long to make a movie like this. You know what I mean? I can't really think of another one that was this, like, tongue-in-cheek about all of these preconceived notions that people have about horror movies, you know? And I was just, as I'm sitting here, I've got the Wikipedia page up on the background of my computer, and the poster's right here, and it, you know, the tagline says, "You think you know the story." And I feel like even now, like, we can kind of have a laugh to ourselves because, you know, we're as not only as cinephiles but as horror fans, which I think is a much broader group of people than people who are really into movies, you know, we do think we know this, and now we can all sort of be in on this joke. And and I think that it's such a unique concept that's, you know, really simple to make work. And I think that they had all of these moments where they could really, you know, have a lot of fun with it. And it's, I don't know about you guys, but the group of people that I saw it with, I think I was one of the few people who left disappointed. I mean, people really seemed to enjoy it. There was an equal amount of, like, you know, scare and laugh, and people really seemed to enjoy the funny parts. I think that all the right moments resonated with people.
You say it's an easy concept to sort of, and that you're surprised it hasn't been really done. In a way, it has been done a little bit, but I don't think it can keep sustain. Like, we can't keep making movies like this. It's gonna, this has to, Like, if somebody else made another film similar to this, it might lose its, in a way, gimmicky
right.
nature.
Yeah. Like, exactly.
But I also feel like a lot more movies have been playing with genre lately, because that's sort of what the point we've gotten to with films, because we're so saturated with the same stuff over and over and over again, that now, instead of making something wholly original, what we're doing is taking our oversaturation and having fun with that. And I feel like that's a pretty popular thing to do these days. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. I just don't think movies like this are going to go down in history as being great films in and of themselves. They're more fun films for the time. I don't know if that really makes sense, but
right.
like a good film with a good original story isn't necessarily just playing with genre so much that without that you're not left with anything. Because at the end of the day, with this film, you don't really have those characters that you're rooting for or you're behind, or relationships you really care about. Why this movie works is for an entirely different reason. It's because as an audience, we understand how films work. And the day that we don't have 50 million horror movies that go a certain way, like say in 30 years, you don't see another horror movie like, you know, a regular Cabin in the Woods would be, and then you played this Cabin in the Woods for some 20-year-old that's never seen one, would this movie hold up as a story? Probably not, because it works only on the level of, hey, isn't this funny because I understand this? And that's where I think this movie's not going to resonate in the future, or not necessarily in the future, but like as a film that's going to go down as a film of the time, you know? So I don't
right.
if that makes any sense.
No, I think it does. And yeah, I think that's a good point. That makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I hear. I think it is a movie of the time, and like you're saying, we're getting many more self-aware movies, and I think that is kind of our sign of the times. But spoilers coming. If you don't want to hear them, you should stop the podcast at this point. So what I was thinking from a generational standpoint, the characters at the end, how he was going to die anyway, but he wouldn't let them kill him to sacrifice the rest of the earth, and to sacrifice himself for the rest of the planet. Don't you think that that's such like a generational thing for this yeah. generation of people who are so self-evolved that,
yeah.
you know, they're going to die anyway. Like, if you don't sacrifice yourself, you'll die anyway. And yet he still kind of refuses to, and, you know, it works out so that, you know,
He looks like the good guy, too, you know?
In exactly. a weird way. It's weird yeah. because he's bucking the system. He's like, I'm tired of this kind of, you know.
Which is ironic because you're bucking a system that's not going to exist anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they set it up from the beginning where, you know, he was mentioning in the beginning how, like, you know, they need to, like, start over and blah, blah, blah or whatever. Now, obviously, on such a large scale. But I think, wasn't it obviously the cameo we get at the end with the director, Sigourney Weaver, when she was like, don't you get it? There won't be any type of, like, restart or whatever. And he right. still won't do it. I just think it's such, like, if you think back to, like, you know, the generation of, like, that fought in World War II, and, like, you know, everyone thinks about them as, like, the greatest generation because so many, like, sacrificed so much. And yet here you are, someone in their 20s today, asking them to, you know, sacrifice themselves for the rest of the world, and it's like a nope, even though they're going to die anyway. And I just thought that was an interesting sign of the times.
I agree. I think that was done very purposely.
Yeah.
As a comment on our generation. And I think we could have a whole discussion about the importance or non-importance of these sort of self-aware films that we keep getting over and over again, and why are we getting them? We're getting them because we keep seeing the same films over and over again, and our new way to make original content is to play with the genres and the stories that we keep seeing over and over again, and that's also a generational thing, which this movie sort of touches upon, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, Tyson, you had some specific things you wanted to talk about.
So I just wanted to, my specific issue with this movie was really how it ended. I thought leading up to that point where, because the one kind of recurrent thing that kept popping up throughout the story that they were teasing you with that I don't think paid off in the end. And they had a lot of jokes that really paid off. I thought the joke with Bradley Whitford with the merman, I thought that was funny. Yes. And when it came to pass, I thought that was enjoyable. And, they had little jokey moments that I thought really worked with the characters. The guy who played the fool, I thought that it was, he had his – or Marty, he had his moments that were really funny. And all the little things where I think they might have lost some people, like when Chris Hemsworth hit that wall on his bike, that kind of stuff. Like, I think it's okay in this kind of movie to have those moments and make you laugh. And I think the one where people laughed the loudest was when they finally realized what was going on and how the system worked, and they were in that industrial complex, and you hear the elevator stop in that hallway, and then there's the little, elevator door ding. And I leaned over to Mallory and I said, whatever happens when these doors open, it's going to be priceless. And then all those things came out, like that giant snake, and there was this blood everywhere. And it was so ridiculous. Yeah. But, I thought, this is the kind of movie where you can pull that off, and it was great. But, when each of the characters died, Richard Jenkins would go over and pull those levers, and all that blood would go out into that thing. And I thought that payoff at the end when Sigourney Weaver's talking about how they had to appeal to these ancient gods or the old ones or whatever, I think that there could have been a way to do that a little bit better, that like big figurative, sort of metaphor about.
Well, I think that
people as horror moviegoers, I just think it could have worked a little bit better than it did.
The movie kept building and building and building, and it got to the point where I don't think it, other than the world ending, what really could you do? I mean, clearly we were those gods that wanted the show, that wanted the blood. I think there was a reason they didn't really show them, or just, they were just there. They just existed. They just needed to be – to make this quote-unquote plot move along. And I think this movie did a really good job as far as balancing the elements so that it's not – it wasn't just a full satire, though. This movie was – in itself had its own stakes, so it wasn't like it was. I think there was a few times this movie went over onto that, fell onto that side of satirical, and it started when all these monsters and mythical creatures got released, because then you started seeing stuff like clowns and unicorns and stuff that I don't think fit into the construct of what this movie was doing. And the movie was doing a really good job up until that point of although how crazy it is, making it realistic in terms of the world this movie created. But then when you got something like a clown and a unicorn, you're kind of like, all right, these are sort of man-made fears, or with a unicorn, I guess, mythology. And I felt like for those few moments, there was a few moments in the film where it lost its track and turned into a little bit more of a satirical rather than a smart sort of play on the genre. But I think overall it did a good job of balancing that, because that's really – it could have gone off the rails a lot of times, in my opinion.
I do think the film did a good job not going off the rails too crazy, although obviously it gets pretty crazy there. But I want to talk a little bit about the influences that the movie had, because I know watching it, the big influence that stuck out to me was the movie Cube. just in like the elevator design. And then also you saw little kind of homages, like when they had the big board up when everyone was betting. They had Deadites up there, which is obviously like an Evil Dead reference.
Right.
And then
yeah.
when I read some more up on it, I saw that they also, I didn't see it when I watched it, but they also had Angry Molesting Tree, which is also from Evil Dead. So I think this film, it's like it knows where the horror genre has come from, and it has fun playing with like those types of situations that have come before, whether it's having like that one of those characters in an elevator, or you know, having little homages like that, and then it wants to play with all those tropes of the genre, and I think that's what really made it so fun for me, was just seeing them look to the past of the horror film and see like what's come before it, and then just kind of twist all of those things around, and yet it just works so well for me. I think that's what I really enjoyed about it. So this film was shot in March of 2009, so it was shot over 3 years ago, and so it was a long 3 year wait before it actually made it to theaters, and apparently this was due to MGM filing for bankruptcy, and then as they're coming out of like the bankruptcy proceedings, they wanted to change the movie to 3D to cash in on the 3D craze, and Joss Whedon and director Drew Goddard were really against it. They said, absolutely not, we're not going to do that. So that pushed it back more, and then MGM finally sold the rights to the movie to, I believe, Lionsgate, who has now released it in theaters. And so this movie's just kind of had a really long road to actually making it into theaters for people to see. And usually when that happens, when you have a movie that's been sitting on a shelf, it's because the studio realizes it was awful, it was crap, it's not going to do very well. But in this situation, I think it's one of those rare occasions where you actually have a good film that just kind of got lost in the shuffle. That took so long to get out, and I think it's a little unfortunate, just because it is so good, and you know, I'm happy I finally got it, was able to see it, but it was worth the wait, I guess, would be my opinion.
I think it actually was fortunate in a way, at least for Lionsgate, because
yeah, for Lionsgate definitely.
Yeah, this comes out right before The Avengers, which is directed and written by Joss Whedon, and obviously Chris Hemsworth plays Thor. So, and we in the original Thor movie, even though this was shot before, it came out previous to this. So I think as far as this movie making more money, it helped that this was that it was pushed and that MGM got bankrupt and it came out when it did, because I think it really worked for the film overall.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. I think it definitely helped out the marketability of Chris Hemsworth as one of the main characters in it, because this is a huge year for him. Yeah. We were kind of talking a little bit before we got rolling, but you know, he has the Avengers, he has this, and he has Snow White and the Huntsman coming out, so...
Yeah, and especially when you look at what he's done prior to this, I remember, you know, him in Star Trek as Kirk's father, and, you know, that was one of the first movies he'd made, and that wasn't too long ago, and now he's just blowing up, and it's... like Jeremy said, I think it is a little bit fortuitous that it's worked out this way for them, because... You know, as time has passed, I think that he's become quite, you know, obviously he's come quite a bit more marketable for them than he would have been when they would have released it. And he is far, you know, it makes sense when you think about it in the context of having filmed it back then. But to look at it now, he's such a bigger star than any of the other stars that, you know, at least to most people that would be in the movie. I mean, I guess... You could make a case for at least Richard Jenkins being somewhat of a star, but the rest of those people are out of unknowns, and so.
Hey, don't you bash Bradley Whitford like that, sir?
And Bradley
he's a
Whitford
star
too,
in my
yeah.
book. and I, another kind of one of the strange little factoids about this is that the two movies that MGM kind of got lost in the shuffle were Cabin in the Woods and Red Dawn, which coincidentally enough also stars Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah.
And now that's coming out in like November of this year, I guess. So yeah, it's kind of strange that both the movies that kind of got lost in the shuffle both starred Chris Hemsworth. But yeah, I mean it's interesting, and I think Lionsgate definitely lucked out. I think I remember reading that Lionsgate bought the film for the rights to the film for less than what it was made for. I think that might be where that $12 million comes from Wikipedia. That might be what Lionsgate bought the movie for. From a budget of $30 million, excuse me.
Yeah,
but that seems crazy that they would buy it for $12 million. I mean, it worked out for them, but
yeah. But well,
MGM
wasn't
able to release it. Now they have $30 million that they put into it. Now they get they get $12 million back out of that.
Yeah,
and
I think if when they're going through bankruptcy, they're just trying to get cash. You know, right then, you know, that might have been why they decided to unload it. Right. I think that's. That might be why that's the $12 million number from Wikipedia, although I'm not 100% sure. But anyway, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a bittersweet. No, not bittersweet. That's not the word I'm looking for. It kind of helped. It kind of worked out well for them that it actually got pushed back. As strange as that sounds.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost. In time, like tears in rain. Time to die.
All right, so we're going to do our top five genre-bending films, or films that sort of deconstruct a genre. I guess that's all we really had to go by. I'll start with you, Brantley. Do you have any criteria?
My criteria is it's really just you know, any movies that I think, you know, you can't really easily define them. You know, you can't, it's not a straight horror movie, or it's not a straight sci-fi movie or anything like that. So I think some of them tend to be very weird because they don't fit into any of those genres. But my number five is Naked Lunch. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but it's based on the William S. Burroughs book, and it stars Peter Weller from RoboCop. And it's about a exterminator who gets hooked on his own bug spray and gets high off of it. And then when his wife dies from an overdose, he tries to quit, and it's just about all these weird, crazy hallucinations he's constantly like seeing while he's under. So it's really weird and messed up, and it's crazy.
Huh. Interesting. Never even
nice.
Heard
of it. Yeah, Naked Lunch. Yeah, it's a weird movie. If you want something really crazy to watch, go for it.
All right. Yeah, my criteria was just that they had to be, if they weren't easily identifiable, you know, genre splits where you could tell that it had components of two genres, I had to be able to justify it pretty well. It's not the most original list, unfortunately, but I have one in particular that I think will probably show up on all of ours. But this is my Blade Runner memorial list. A awesome sci-fi film noir. genre bender. My number five was The Blair Witch Project, which is a it was kind of the first movie that really mixed big components of documentary and horror, and it was so this was before that concept I think got a little bit overdone, and I remember I was a freshman in high school when I saw it, and I remember so vividly where I saw it and how I felt when I saw it, and it felt so real, that it kind of stuck with you for a while, and it's just creepy.
What's interesting about that film is I remember after it came out and it was such a big deal, people sort of dismissed it as this found footage thing, and that it wasn't, you can only do so much with that, and that's what that is. It was well done, whatever. And then you cut to, 12 years later, and every other thing is either found footage or a documentary type thing. It's like,
exactly, yeah,
it's weird. I mean, there was this gap after Blair Witch where people were like, oh, it's a found, we'll dismiss that, and then we picked back up with that and ran with it into the ground.
Yeah, I mean, Elizabeth Olsen is in that new movie Silent House, which is, movies so much later on now are still so reliant on some of those conventions that movie laid out, and it's
right.
I just think it was it doesn't quite get the respect
it deserves. I think the only difference, maybe part of the gap between Blair Witch Project and the others, is technology has gotten so much better.
Yeah.
So you can make a found footage Cloverfield
or Chronicle,
Paranormal Activity or something. Yeah,
exactly.
Nice. All right.
So I think my list is a little bit different. I really took a look at movies that deconstructed the genre, that were very aware of what genre they were playing in, and deconstructed it as a film. And I tried to, 4 out of 5 of these films work without the audience being aware of the deconstruction. So, like, if you didn't know anything about how genres worked or filmmaking, you could still enjoy 4 out of 5 of these films. One of them, which is my number 5, I threw in there as a homage to Cabin in the Woods. It's a movie that came out just a few years ago that did something somewhat similar, and it's called Dale and Tucker Versus Evil.
Oh, okay.
Where it was sort of a spoof on these hick-looking guys go out to a cabin in the woods, and these teenagers show up and think they're murderers, and they keep accidentally killing them all, and they're just two really nice guys.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same sort of idea as Cabin in the Woods, not as complex. It's actually pretty good. It's on Netflix streaming. People should check it out. It's a pretty funny movie.
Okay, so what do we we go to the police?
Call the police?
Yeah.
Tell them what?
I'll tell them what happened.
It's a good idea, Dale.
Oh, hidey-ho, officer. We've had a doozy of a day. There we were, minding our own business, just doing some chores around the house when kids started killing themselves all over my property.
Well, that's what happened, Tucker.
He would have to be a moron to believe that, Dale. It doesn't matter what happened. What matters is what looks like what happened. And what looks like what happened is pretty nasty.
Wait, so I haven't seen it yet, but I've seen that it's been on there for a little while. Do Dale and Tucker kill them, or don't they accidentally kill themselves, the kids? Like,
yeah, well, a little bit of both. Mostly accidentally kill themselves while they're trying to kill Dale and Tucker, who are completely innocent.
Okay, gotcha.
So it's a funny, it's one of those movies you have to know the horror genre to appreciate, very much like Cabin in the Woods. But it deconstructs it pretty well.
All right. My number 4, this is one that might be on your guys' list as well. It's Donnie Darko. I don't
about
know.
It. Just got kicked off.
Yeah, so did I. It just got kicked off mine, too.
I don't even know what to put that in, what category. I mean, very broadly, it's a drama, I guess, but... Go ahead.
It's got a little bit of superhero. He's got discovers that he has kind of a power, and it's got a little bit of horror and a little bit of thriller. I think it's one that definitely works.
Well, what I was always impressed with Donnie Darko about is that basically you got Richard Kelly, who directed it.
Right.
Yeah. It seemed to me that he took all these. He took all these aspects of different movies he likes in different genres he likes. He's like, oh, I like this from E.T., and I like this concept from Harvey, and I like this guy. And he's like, let me see how I can make a movie that uses clearly homages and uses all those things together and works by itself. And that's why I had Donnie Darko originally in as my number four, because he does such a good job of taking these different elements. But if you had never seen any of the movies he references, the movie still works by itself.
All right, yeah. My number four was Back to the Future 3, which is a sci-fi western, and it's obviously my least favorite of the three. But what Michael J. Fox in those movies is great, and it's kind of hard to go wrong, and it's still really enjoyable, with the exception of the very end when they have that awful shot with the train taking off. It was pretty good. So
yeah, no, I enjoy it. I like it more than the second one, but that's just me.
Really, more than the second one?
Yeah.
Wow, I love the second one because of the. Because of the hoverboards.
Yeah, weren't we supposed to get those like 10 years ago?
I know, jeez. Or the jackets that automatically resize. I could totally use clothes like that.
My number four is a film that sort of used, and this filmmaker does it a lot, but I think this one is the movie he did it where it's sort of most clearly defined. He took the heist genre and sort of showed us everything you never see in the heist genre, and that is Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, yeah.
So instead of seeing a heist and seeing how the planning of the heist, you see people get their names and you see after the heist. So, it's a clever send up of a heist film, but again, it works by itself. If you weren't familiar with that genre, you'd still get enjoyment out of that film. But Tarantino is very, very clearly working against the genre in that movie.
Yeah, that's a good pick.
Cool. My number three is, I don't know if you guys have even heard of this movie. It's Sam Fuller's Run of the Arrow. Heard of it?
No, I have not heard of that one.
It's this weird. It's sort of a western. It's not really a drama. It's not really a romance. I mean, it's a film about a Southern Civil War veteran after the Confederacy loses, who goes to live with the Native American tribe in his area. And if that sounds like Dances with Wolves, guess what? Dances with Wolves completely ripped it off. Anyway, it's just a really weird movie that it kind of doesn't fit into any one genre. And Martin Scorsese famously even said that he doesn't even know what that film is. It's just kind of this crazy one of the many crazy weird Sam Fuller films. And I probably could have made a top five with all his films, but. Anyway, Run of the Arrow comes in at number three.
Good day.
Nice. All right, my number three, and this was the one of mine that was kind of a stretch. Like I said, this isn't the most original list. I knew Brantley was going to have some good ones, and so are you, Jeremy. My number three was Inception, which is obviously definitely a very apparent sort of sci-fi concept movie, but. I thought it was also, a great heist story, and it just so happens to take place in somebody's subconscious. But it definitely has a lot of components of different types of movies in there, and so.
Well, I will take your Inception and raise you my number three, which is a Memento.
Nice.
Another Christopher Nolan film that. This one, was the one I was not sure if I was going to put it on because it is a detective film, but I don't, and it is playing with sort of that genre, But it's not so self-aware into the genre that it adds a lot knowing the conventions of most detective films. But I think Nolan, like in Inception, he does a good job of taking something that we've seen a lot and then just making it wholly his own. You know, and it's not even just in the way he composes a lot of the films and is in the structure of the narrative. It really, the structure of the narrative isn't just, oh, let's do this backwards. There's a reason for it. It plays right into the story itself. So I really wanted to give him credit for that.
Nice.
Cool. My number two is Eraserhead. I don't know what you put this movie into. This is, I think, David Lynch's directorial debut, and I don't even know really how to describe the movie. Have either of you guys seen it?
I haven't yet.
Oh, I've heard of it. I've just not seen it.
Yeah, it's just, again, yeah, I don't even know how to describe it. It's just so out there and so weird. It's not horror. It's not really sci-fi. It's not really a fantasy. It's just kind of this really strange movie. And, I mean, it's really basically David Lynch, I think, at his, like, absolute weirdest. And, yeah, so that's why it's my number two, just because I wouldn't even know where to start in terms of classifying this movie.
It's a movie I should see. I mean, I've seen a handful of David Lynch films. It's like, it's one of those blind spots for me. I really need to see more Lynch films. And I actually am halfway through Twin Peaks right now, so that's...
So you got through the first season?
No, not yet. I'm almost done the first season.
My number two was Shaun of the Dead.
Now, some of these are limited.
What was that?
I think it was Blue Monday.
That was the original presser.
I'm sorry.
Purple Rain.
No.
Sign of the Times.
Definitely not.
The Batman soundtrack.
Sorry.
Okay. Oh, Dire Straits.
Throw it.
Obviously, it's a very funny movie, and probably it's a little bit funnier than it is scary, but it's, I guess maybe rather than a comedy horror, it's more of a comedy zombie movie, but, you know, it's such a great movie. I own it on HD DVD, actually.
Hey, I think so. I might own it on there, too.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of kitsch value to it now, but,
it's a perfect pick. It is.
Yeah, obviously, just you know, it works really well as far as taking components of two genres, and it's a really fun movie. So that's my number two.
Good pick.
All right, my number two is a film that really likes to play with the romantic comedy. Well, not even romantic comedy, more of a romance film, and it is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. One of the best romance movies ever made, from the mind of Charlie Kaufman, that really gets to the heart of relationships through this weird thing of erasing your memories. I mean, if you haven't seen it, it's brilliant, and you should see it. I don't want to give too much away, but it really, as far as understanding the genre of the romance film, it understands it and puts, weirdly enough, a huge level of truth into it while playing with a sci-fi element.
Yeah, definitely. That was one of my honorable mentions.
That was another one that I was on my didn't quite make it list, though.
Yeah.
So my number one, this might get a groan from Jeremy, but it is Samuel Fuller's Shock Corridor.
Witness number two, Trent. Only Negro student in a Southern university. Hobby, collecting pillowcases.
Trent!
Yes, sir?
The pillowcase is missing.
I don't have it, sir.
It's from your bed.
I don't have it, sir.
Want to go back into the hall?
I don't have it, sir.
Let him keep it.
Keep out of this, Wilkes.
Dr. Christo said not to get him excited.
You know what that pillowcase means.
That's all right, Trent. We know you don't have it.
Thank you, sir.
I like Shock Corridor a lot.
I know you like it, but I thought it might get a groan because you're like, oh, it's two Sam Fuller movies. But it, I mean, I don't. Again, this is another movie where he was kind of in his early 60s, kind of really weird phase where he did like this and The Naked Kiss, like back to back. And this is it's about a journalist who goes into a at the time it was called an insane asylum to try to solve a murder and like kind of get a Pulitzer Prize in the process, and then kind of as it goes on you're not really sure if he's going crazy while he's in there, et cetera. And so it's not really a drama. It's not really a murder mystery. It's not really a psychological thriller. It's just kind of this really weird, off the wall movie. And yeah, it's my number one.
Nice.
Yeah, I would certainly recommend that film to people because it's not only hard to define. I wouldn't put it in any sort of genre, but I think what Sam Fuller does best is he finds these stories, these really sort of out there stories that he can use to shed light on a lot of different political and social problems, especially of the time. It's kind of amazing how he does it. Like, mm-hmm. he'll pick a story like this where you a totally random story of a writer going into a mental hospital to win a Pulitzer Prize, and he'll start dealing with issues of race and you know, other political issues of the time, and I think media and stuff, and I think he's one of the best at doing that.
Nice. All right. Well, my number one, I'm kind of surprised. I'll be surprised if no one else has this. For me, when I think genre-bending films, this is the one that immediately pops into my head, and this is probably the least original pick possible, is Alien.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that it's, you know, one of my favorite movies, and I think this was one of the first, you know, I mean, the tagline, "In space, no one can hear you scream," that kind of plays to the genre bending component, and that it is very much a sci-fi movie, but it's, you know,
more a horror movie.
Exactly.
And this on the heels of Prometheus coming out.
Yeah, exactly. So that's my number one.
All right, good pick. And I guess it's on to me. Now, this movie is not genre bending, but it's a film that really understands the genre it's in and flips it on its head without ever losing sight of the story itself. It's a film that, if you know the components of this genre, you really get a lot out of it, but if you don't, it's still a great film, and it is Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven.
Oh,
yeah. Western that's about nonviolence.
Kind of neo-noir a little.
Yeah, that plays into all of these conventions while defying them at the same time. I mean, it's one of my favorite movies ever, and I really appreciate what it was doing for the Western genre at the time.
That was the first one.
First one what?
First one I ever killed.
Yeah?
You know how I said I shot five men? It weren't true. That Mexican had come at me with a knife. I just busted his leg with a shovel. I didn't kill him nothing either.
Well, you sure killed the hell out of that fella today.
All right, there you go. Yeah. There you have it.
Did you guys have any big honorable mentions?
I wrote down probably about like 25 movies.
Yeah.
And then, like, limited my list from there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, I had a ton. Like, Rocky Horror Picture Show was on there, and Dogtooth, Meet the Feebles, Repulsion, Happiness. I mean, it's just, like, I had, like, a bunch on there.
One that I had that I didn't put on, but it was a movie that I really enjoyed. I first saw it with my dad. That was a movie that he really enjoyed. It was the movie Westworld. I don't know if you guys have seen it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's. I thought about putting that in place of my Back to the Future 3, which is also a sci-fi western. But I remember I saw it when I was pretty young, and just thinking it was just so crazy before some of those concepts still really registered. And it's a pretty cool movie. So,
Yeah. Was it Yul Brynner?
Yul Brynner, yeah.
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 Brantley, you mentioned Dogtooth.
Yep.
I have a quick story about that movie.
All right.
One of my friends from college, she was texting me, like, what's a movie? I'm bored. What's a movie on Netflix Instant I can watch? And I was like, I was thinking, and I remember that Dogtooth was on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just told her that I told her to check out Dogtooth. It's like this, it's a really funny movie. Funny movie about just a quirky little family. And mm-hmm. So she's like, really? I'm like, yeah, definitely, you should check it out, absolutely. So she puts it on and she starts texting me like the stuff that, you know, in the movie she said it's happening. Like, I'm like, no, just keep watching it. It gets really funny. And then it gets sicker and sicker. And she's like,
yeah.
What did you mean? I'm like, just keep watching it. You'll see at the end, there's a twist at the end. And then obviously there's no twist, and it's just mm-hmm. a very disturbing. It's an unbelievable movie, which I think is actually hilarious personally. But, and I think the filmmakers meant for it to be as black a humor as you can get. But mm-hmm. for her, it was a
traumatizing, probably.
It was a pretty good prank when she thought she was going to watch like some family-friendly, quirky, funny movie.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up this edition of the Get Your Film Fix podcast. We encourage everyone to check out the site, getyourfilmfix.com. You can see all of our podcasts there. It also lists like all of our top fives within those podcasts, and you can see other reviews and articles there as well. And we want to encourage everybody to keep listening. Thank you very much.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.